Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor, and for more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with the editors of the fantastic documentary on the life and death of chef and author Anthony Bourdain. The film is called Roadrunner. The film was directed by Morgan Neville, who also directed the Fred Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor. The editors of Roadrunner are Eileen Meyer and Aaron Wickenden. I've had both of them on Art of the Cut in the past, Eileen for the documentary Crypt Camp, and Aaron for a doc called Hail Satan. Eileen's other editing work includes Best of Enemies, Buckley vs. Vidal, Alabama Bound, and Television Event. And she was an additional editor on Clive Davis, The Soundtrack of Our Lives. Her TV work includes an episode of The First 48 and the documentary miniseries The Devil Next Door. Aaron's worked with Eileen before on both Best of Enemies and Television Event. His filmography also includes The Trials of Muhammad Ali, the Orson Welles documentary They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, the aforementioned Fred Rogers documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor, and the Michelle Obama documentary Becoming. Also, episodes of Frontline and POV. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. So Eileen and Aaron, it is really great to have you on the show. It was so great to talk to you both in the past. And I wanted to just jump right in about the beginning of the documentary, because I don't know whether this is necessarily true, but I really feel like the way a documentary starts is even more important than the way a feature film starts, for example. It's just critical to set the documentary up with the right tone, with the right intent, and kind of getting the audience pointed in the right direction. And this documentary, I think, does a great job. The opening credit sequence is pure rock and roll and is just a blast.
When we were crafting the opening, one of the things that Morgan Neville, our director, was interested in was establishing some of the aesthetic rules for the film. And we really wanted people out of the gate to understand this wasn't going to be like a greatest hits assembly. We're going to be taking you through different episodes. We didn't want it to look just like the show itself. For example, the story kind of opens and Tony having a conversation to someone off camera about death. And in that footage, in the raw footage, and we had raw footage from like any episode we really wanted access to, particularly from later shows like Parts Unknown. And so we had that covered beautifully from, there's a shot, reverse shot, a wide angle. I think they had three cameras going. We had it all. And instead of cutting it in a way that you knew who he was having a conversation with, where you understood where he was, we wanted to kind of disassociate you from all of those things that are the aesthetics of the show. So right out of the gate, establish that we're in a very different kind of storytelling mode that's not something you've seen before. So that was really important for Morgan to be able to hook the audience and demonstrate right out of the gate, this is something new. One other thing, and maybe Eileen could speak to this better, was that Morgan was also really interested in the openings of films like Trainspotting. And it starts and immediately sort of establishes this narrative tone where in Trainspotting, you hear Ewan McGregor and he's taking you through meeting different people in his life, explaining his kind of philosophy. And it's all done to a really jamming song. I think it was Lust for Life by Iggy Pop. And so that was also a template for us. We wanted to establish right out of the gate that this is a film that was going to be narrated as much as possible by Tony from his perspective. And so establishing his voice and having him bring you into his world was also really important.
And in that opening discussion, you said, even though you had the coverage of him talking and you could have cut to his face, that was, I only saw the documentary once. It was like a beach and water or something like that.
Yeah, you're right. The scene is basically shot for Parts Unknown. It's an episode where he's talking to an anthropologist about death. And so they're having a very deep discussion about different cultures and their attitudes towards death. And Tony is reflecting on his own life experience, his own ideas about his own death, which was something he talked about a lot throughout his whole career and all the different television shows and his books. And so the way it was shot for Parts Unknown was really this kind of traditional sort of conversation on the beach between between two people. And so in the edit we did for the film, not only did we remove the sort of sense of where we are, who he's talking to, but we also resisted the temptation to cut between one of these other beautiful angles. And we just stayed on Tony and then pushed in and jump cut because we wanted to avoid this feeling like we were in the show.
The whole opening credit sequence is super rock and roll. It's very fun, upbeat, and gives you a great sense of what you're going to expect to come. Can you guys talk to me about assembling that and the decision to go, hey, you know what? We have all this footage from the show, but we're going to cut to samurai movies and Steve McQueen movies and all this other stuff.
Yeah, I think this is a great opportunity to give a shout out to our associate editor, Alana Burns, who is an amazing editor. And she actually did the first assembly of the opening credits, even before I came on to the project. It was the very first thing that got built as a proof of concept type of thing. And then Aaron really refined it and worked in those film clips in really creative ways. But I think it was really Alana's initial pass on it that it didn't change that much, because Morgan always knew he wanted to use the song Roadrunner from the very, very beginning of the idea for the film.
Yeah, one of the ideas that we get to pretty early in the film is this idea that Tony was a cinephile. And before he became known as this person who was traveling the world, experiencing food and culture and crafting this unique voice, he really hadn't traveled that much, particularly outside of the country. And so one of his friends talks in the film about how all of his references for what the world was like were these romantic visions that came from movies. And so we were looking for opportunities throughout the film to pepper in those romanticized visions of the world and films that we knew were films that he loved and talked about were things that we tried to weave into the movie. For example, in the film, there's footage from The Searchers, which Eileen cut, which is really beautiful. All these references were an attempt to kind of bring you into this romanticized vision of the world.
At the beginning, there's also a great promise. I always think of movies that you set up a promise to the audience. This is what I'm going to give you if you stick around till the end. And Anthony says, what am I doing here? I shall endeavor to explain. A great little soundbite to start the thing off with, I think. Can you guys talk about how much someone handed you a script and how much, because documentaries are done many different ways, of course, and sometimes the editors, you got to go, oh my gosh, I just found this great soundbite of him saying, I shall endeavor to explain. This has got to go in someplace.
We had a really amazing post team. We had associate producer, a co-producer, an associate editor, and the three of them started on the film like 6 months before I even came onto the project. And then I came onto the project first, and then Aaron came on about 4 or 5 months into the edit. And really, our associate producer, Chloe, she started the process of going through all of the episodes of all of Tony's shows. And she was the first one on the project. She was like sitting in a basement, just watching and watching and taking down every single note about every episode and putting it into a massive spreadsheet. At the same time, Morgan was collecting all of the music references and film references that Tony ever talked about or that were important to him. And then they created a soundbite Bible, basically, of everything that Tony ever said or wrote that was relevant to the concepts we wanted in the film. And that was all in a spreadsheet. So it was just a massive sort of preparation getting ready for the edit. So by the time I came onto the project, they already had a board with note cards, basically, of the scenes and concepts that were emerging from all of the material. So there was like somewhat of a basic structure idea in place when I came onto it.
I loved a moment early in the film. This kind of goes to style. Before you formally introduce Joel Rose, you cut to this moment of him sitting in his interview waiting to be interviewed, and then there's some verite footage, and then you actually see the interview that the previous shot was from. And then throughout the rest of the movie, that's a style that you use, I think, every time, if not almost every time. Can you talk to me about deciding to do that and what the purpose of that was?
Yeah. So that was also an early idea that Morgan and I talked about trying. And I think the idea behind it was basically to highlight and acknowledge the importance of each person that we included in the film in Tony's life. So you see them and then you see them in archive at the moment where they are interacting with Tony in some way. And so it was a way of getting into the interviewees' memory of their experience, and that the film is like a firsthand account of that memory.
I love it. And as an audience member, one of the things it did for me after the first one was it let me know that whoever I was about to see next, whatever I was about to see next was important, and we were transitioning to something new that, oh, here's a new person. So as an audience member, it was also kind of cool to have almost a foreshadowing.
And one of the things I love about the way that Morgan staged the interviews for this film also is that he talks often about how he gets his kind of toolkit of ideas of how to approach a subject from the subject that he's doing a documentary about. For example, with Won't You Be My Neighbor, the film about Mr. Rogers, all the interviews are shot direct to camera, you know, people looking right in the lens. With this film, he really wanted to also create a sense of intimacy, which reflects on this editing technique that we were using. And he did it by having all the interview subjects sit across a table from him in restaurants. And so the physical proximity was also really close. So you have that real sense of warmth of sharing a story with a friend. And then oftentimes, because they're restaurants, they're lit with candles. And so I think the combination of those techniques and ways of creating a kind of like dynamic in the interview, which is really different from how most interviews are done, plus this editing element really combined to create a real sense of someone like coming into Tony's story, into the film, and giving a testimonial in a way. There is a sense of honoring him, which I really like about how these elements all work together. In tandem.
I'm going to preface this by saying I know that this is a sore subject, and if you guys don't want to talk about it, I understand, but I want to ask about this. When Joel describes the email in Tokyo and the email is read by Bourdain, is that AI technology that people talked about that this film used?
No, that actually isn't. That's something that Tony recorded for, I think, was it one of the audio?
No, it was an episode of Parts Unknown. Yeah.
So like from the get-go, one of the concepts that Morgan had for the film, like when he talked to me about cutting this with Eileen, and this is before he had shot a single interview, as things were coming together, the whole concept was based around the idea of having Tony narrate the film as much as possible. So that was going to be pulled from all these different elements, whether it was the episodes of the show, raw footage that hadn't been used, the audiobooks that he recorded, and on and on. And then in the instances when he wrote something and he was a prolific writer and there wasn't a recording of it, this idea of using the AI to create the audio of what he actually said was something that we had talked about. And I think part of the creative concept was all linked to this thing that Morgan was excited about, which was creatively reflecting a movie like Sunset Boulevard, where everything is narrated posthumously. And that's actually a movie that Tony would creatively quote from on episodes of his show. He recreated Sunset Boulevard in shows. So we thought that this was like a really great way to pay homage to him, to his creative life. And so that idea of using that additional technique to have things be as seamless as possible and really give the viewer an immersive experience into his voice and his perspective was where we were coming from when we used that technique.
Where was it used if it wasn't used in that Tokyo footage?
I was going to say there's two emails in the film. So the second email that he writes to Dave Cho, where he's like, you are successful, I'm successful, are you happy? That email where it transitions from Dave Cho reading it to Tony's voice reading it later in the film.
And that's a beautiful segment. You could imagine a cheap shot editorial idea of let's just have it typed out on the screen and shoot the... But you guys really, it's very cinematic the way it was done. There's beautiful shots that you feel like he's actually thinking about the words that he's saying. It's really beautifully done.
Thank you. Yeah, I think there's a few other spots in the film where we did use it as well. They're very short and all totally verbatim things that Tony wrote. And so I think the entire time building the film, we didn't even know if it would work. It was just one of the many things we were trying out as a creative tool. And it wasn't working for a very long time. So it's like actually a really difficult technology.
I talked to Jabez Olson, who did the Get Back documentary. And although it's not the same technology, they used AI to be able to separate the voices of a mono recording. So somehow the AI is able to say, I recognize John's voice, and I recognize Paul's voice, and I recognize the sound of guitars, and I can split those things out into three separate tracks, even though it was a mono recording. It's amazing. And they didn't have that until the last year of the documentary. There were scenes that they didn't think they could use because the guitars were too heavy against the voices, and then they used this technology to salvage those moments. So I love it. One of the things I want to talk about is the choice of some B-roll shots to deliver character and personality and mood or tone. Anthony goes into this dive bar, and you guys cut to a camera shot pointing down at the floor with a cable dangling in the shot. I thought it was very rock and roll, and just seemed like, hey, there's a camera crew there, an acknowledgement of that. And shortly after that, there's a new interviewee who's introduced, and there's a shot of an alarm clock hooked to a bundle of TNT. Talk to me about finding those great little shots and going, yes, I'm going to use this shot of the floor. I'm going to use this shot of this TNT.
Yeah, so definitely the shot of the floor, like using all of those behind the scenes type shots gives you a certain vibe that is like you have special access to this material. This is the raw material that no one has ever seen before. So you get the sense of like the access that we had to the material, which is like very different than watching the episodes of Parts Unknown that are all very like slick. And like Aaron was saying, we did everything we could to make it not feel like the show, that it was something different. The shot of the alarm clock is just one of my favorite things. And just like playing with the different shots. We had all kinds of amazing little nuggets and just really cool stuff, especially in that early archival material that no one had ever seen. It was like shot by a guy who was making a documentary about Tony at that time and filmed him quite a lot right in that one time period, but then never did anything with it. So it was just an amazing treat that we had that. And then we also had the raw material behind all the shows. So it's just a wealth of material. So we were constantly just finding the most amazing stuff to use.
Do you have any idea how much material you had? Did anybody go, okay, it is truly 800 hours of material or something crazy?
I think Morgan said we went through about 10,000 hours of material, but there was 20,000 hours or something that there was no way we could ever get into all the material.
One of the things that was so unique about the edit is this edit happened right around the beginning of the pandemic. And so originally when we were getting all of the posts set up for this project, having something this massive, it really would have been nice to all do it in one place. But because of the pandemic, we were scattered. We all worked from home. I worked from Chicago. Eileen was from Los Angeles and other places as well. And Morgan was in Los Angeles. Our assistant editors were in LA, but we all were working independently. So the media management for this was crazy. It wasn't just one show that Tony had done during his life. It was like Cook's Tour, No Reservations, The Layover, Parts Unknown. And we weren't just dealing with layoffs of episodes. We were, at the very least, it was an episode with split tracks and then sometimes additional footage for episodes. But then later shows, we had multi-camera coverage. So it was just a massive job going through all this material. Going back to one of your questions about a script. Yeah, while we have these kind of organizing concepts, how any given concept is articulated is something that is in a large part what Eileen and I bring to the table. How it's articulated through ideas that are expressed in interviews and how those dovetail with the archival clips, and then even just tone and how all those things fit together. There's a loose idea, but Morgan's also very open to us just bringing all kinds of creative ideas to the table.
I love that. I definitely want to get into tone shortly, but I'm just going to go through my questions in the order that basically the order that I watched the show is how these questions are coming as I was jotting away. There's a Bangkok segment, which was one of the places where I really felt a score moment. It's very cinematic, and it was definitely not telling you how to feel. It was unsettling, but it was kind of like a choir of angels, like a dark angels, but angels. I don't know if you guys know the piece I'm talking about. Can you talk about not the Roadrunner type sound, but the score and the temp that you might have used to create those moments?
Yeah, so I think the way that we did this score for this film was really different than any other film I've ever worked on. we ended up licensing a lot of the temp music that we used because we just fell in love with it as we were going. And then we had three different composers making different tracks for the film, in addition to licensing the temp music and the needle drops that we ended up using. So it was just, the music in the film is very eclectic. It comes from a lot of different places. The one track that you're talking about is from another film, and we just license it. And people actually point it out, because I think in the other film that it's from, it's like a very different vibe situation, but the track works in like two very different ways. And so people get freaked out about it if they know the other film that it's from.
Well, it's Hereditary, right? It's this track Reborn by Colin Stetson. I haven't seen Hereditary, so I don't know. I don't actually know. How does it play in Hereditary?
I should have known that, because I cut a horror film and I used temp music from Hereditary. So I should have known that was what that was from, but I did not know.
It's an amazing track.
Yeah. That's why I downloaded that soundtrack. I'm like, this whole thing is amazing, but I just didn't recognize it, especially in that context. I was not thinking about that. That's so cool. Another question I've got about editors knowing what they need for a specific moment, either pace-wise or shot size-wise. Going into 2006 Beirut, it starts with a series of explosions at an airport runway. And I'm thinking it's news archival footage and not something that they shot for the show. But then there's also footage of that was shot on a TV screen. It's super macro, where you see pixels and that stuff. Is that something where you guys felt, I want to up the pace, or I want a close up and I need a close up and I'll just generate it by shooting the screen? Or was that something that you had access to without creating it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure all of that material was from the show.
Wow.
Actually, because the show that they created about that experience was very different than a lot of the other shows and included a lot of like archival footage, I think. I don't remember exactly, but I don't think we used anything that was not from the show for that part. But I think a lot in this film, we tried to play with juxtapositions and subtle and not so subtle references or metaphors of what was going on in Tony's life. And that episode comes right after he's talking about his divorce and blowing up his life. And then we cut to the explosions and the bombs. So there's a lot of those types of edits in the film that are very deliberate.
And that section, as you said, that show was unlike many of his other shows. He's coming to a realization at that point in the documentary and in his life of, is making cooking shows what it's all about? Like, there seems to be so much more going on in the world that needs to be dealt with. People are suffering. And it gets pretty profound and pretty deep right in that segment. And there's a great, I loved it, there's a great held shot of the wake of a ship as it's departing. And I just love that moment that you guys held that after something profound has been said, so the audience can absorb it. Can you talk to me about pacing those moments and going, geez, I feel like the audience needs this moment. Let's just let it breathe here.
I think that particular moment actually came from Tony. That was the actual end of the episode. And so what he's saying there and the shot is what they use at the end of the episode. It's Tony's actual reflection on the whole experience. So I think when we found those sort of artistic decisions from Tony's work, it was really important to show some of that as well. Even though we didn't want the film to feel like we're in the show, it's still important to really define what made Tony such a great writer and TV creator.
Yeah, a lot of the documentary is about him discovering that the exploration of making a TV show can be so much more. Like, it doesn't have to be Rick Steves' Europe. It can be him. It can be something unique and special and creative and fun.
I think one of the other things about that episode that was so important to highlight was that this is kind of a coming into an understanding that there aren't easy answers, that things are complicated, and that the gray area that things exist in and the complexity of situations was something that he was drawn to. So this is also a real turning point in the film. So when you talk about allowing time for that to sink in and breathe, it was also deliberate in terms of the edit to highlight for the viewer, this is a real real turning point in Tony's understanding. It's an important moment in his story. And we actually used one of the technologies that you were talking about earlier that was used on Get Back for this purpose, because this was one of the episodes, because it was early, we didn't have split tracks. So they had their own musical score over the whole ending, and it really was not the tone we were going for. Like, we didn't really want to quote directly from the episode, make you feel like you were watching the episode. We wanted it to kind of mesh with the film. And so we used that same technology from Get Back to be able to separate Tony's voice from the musical score that they had in the piece, throw out that score and use our own score.
Wow. There's a great montage. I can't remember what the name of the French song. It's a male French singer singing, and Anthony's walking from behind in various exotic locales, and it ends with a reading about international narcotic trafficker being arrested. And then you guys chose to do a split screen, and maybe it's from the show, you chose to do a split screen of him reading from two separate cameras instead of just choosing one or the other. Can you talk about that decision and what that was about? Eileen is being pointed to.
Yeah, Eileen cut that. So I'm like, you should talk about that. Like, you know,
I loved it. I absolutely loved that whole little section. Was so fun, and I just loved it.
Yeah, the split screen was definitely not from the show, but we had both angles. And I think it was just the montage of Tony walking in different places. That was also an idea that Morgan had, that he wanted to try that because it was a really quick way of telling you like how many places he had been in such a short amount of time. And the fact that we could like match cut like him walking in all these different places was like a super fun editing challenge. But the split screen was just like, I think, a way of being playful with the different angles and the coverage that we had. And also it has the same vibe as the behind the scenes type stuff where you're like, we're telling the audience, we have all this stuff to use and why not use it?
And later on it's used again, he's in a car with somebody and it's probably two GoPros or something that are combined.
Good eye. Yeah, it's two GoPros. So you had like an angle on him and an angle on Asia. And the movie is 2:35. And so we were able to take the two different GoPros and put them together. And you'd have that moment in sync of the two of them driving together.
Yeah, I love that. That was really cool. There are various locales and shows that are glimpsed, like Laos and Haiti. But surely you added together more of those than the ones that made it into the final doc. Can you tell us a little bit about what guided those choices of what stayed and what went? What went on the cutting room floor and why?
Yeah, there were a few.
Do you have a full list, really?
Yeah.
Eileen and I got together and we talked about some of the scenes that were cut out. So we just had a list.
I remember a lot of them. There were a few favorite scenes that got cut that I still am sad about. But I think the reason that some of them got cut out was some for time, obviously. We don't want to make the film too long. And then also some of them were just double beats of concepts. So there was an episode where Tony gets a tattoo where he basically says, I am certain of nothing. That's like what the tattoo says in ancient Greek. And that was really profound, I think, for us. Like that was Tony's worldview. I am certain of nothing. That's why he's always searching. But it ended up, we already kind of understood that from other scenes. And so it just ended up at the very last minute getting cut out. It's one of my favorite scenes.
And there are a couple other scenes of him getting tattoos. Obviously, that's a pretty poignant one, but he definitely gets some tattoos. Talk to me about changes in tone. The movie definitely goes through changes in tone. I watched the whole first kind of rock and roll part, and my son wasn't there, and he came in for some of the heavier stuff. And I thought, he's seeing a very different movie than what I've seen so far. Talk to me about making those changes in tone and what were the editorial things that you had to do to not be jarred? Because I never felt like I was jarred. I just felt like, oh, now I'm in a different tone and now I'm in a different tone. That must have been difficult.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that was really unique about this edit was how Eileen and I, our participation happened at different stages. When Eileen started, one of the things that Morgan talked about was that he didn't want the film to be maudlin, and this just sense throughout the whole film that we're talking about someone who died by suicide and that we're going to be spending so much time in that feeling and that tone. He wanted to bring Tony back, in his own words, in a way that felt full of life and excitement, the way that it felt at that time with all the people. And so editorially, one of the rules he set up with Eileen was for Eileen not to look at any of the footage from our interviews, which were all very, very emotional interviews, but not to look at anything that had to do with the aftermath of Tony's passing. So Eileen worked with the rest of the team and with Morgan and built the first up through late in the second act of the movie. And then when I came on 5 months or so after Eileen got started and the two of us worked in tandem for the rest of the cut, my job was to jump into all of that material, the heavy portion of the interviews, and build out that kind of back part of the film. And then the two of us together went and found a way to have all the different elements integrated. Because at a certain point in Tony's life, things did start to unravel. He started cutting ties to his friends, distancing himself from people, having more extreme highs and lows that people were noticing. And so the film gets into that and reflects it as people are seeing it kind of happen. So yeah, if you walk into the film late, you do get a different, you do get a very different experience. So I think like tonally as a whole, it was important for the first part of the movie to have that kind of enthusiasm and that excitement. You know, Tony talked about how everyone on his crew were like pirates and they were on a pirate ship together, exploring the world and going on these adventures. And so that was important to capture and not have it compromised by this feeling of retrospectively looking at things through the lens of him having died by suicide.
And I really felt like you needed that opening. One, you wanted to see that part of his life too, because certainly that's how I kind of remember him as a TV audience member. But it's also like you need that so that you're buoyed enough that you can handle the dip at the end. Because otherwise, if you just started the movie halfway through and went to the end, I don't know what kind of experience that would be for the audience. But because you've been set up with this great, high, emotional, exciting rock and roll first two-thirds of the movie, you're able to appreciate the end of the movie.
It was a really interesting method editing type of experience for me, because I felt like it was my job to be as much in Tony's mindset in present tense of where we were at in his experience as possible, without looking at it retrospectively or through the lens of the suicide or his death or all the stuff that was coming at the end. And so Morgan and I built the edit linearly. So I started at the beginning and I just built it so that I was feeling the cumulative effect of Tony's life and how things were changing. And I was just very much in the present with Tony all the time.
For me, and I've done some documentaries and films where they're pretty heavy, and you think that makes the back part of that film pretty difficult to edit, right? When you have to be in his headspace for some very dark times.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it was also a challenge to balance out that section with the rest of the film so it just didn't feel like two totally different experiences. So I think there were a number of ways that we were able to tackle that. And one is by once we had a full cut of the film going through and then balancing certain elements, like you mentioned the ticking time bomb shot in Act One, things that are playful and tossed off like that, but also touch on the theme and the sort of idea of things leading towards the end. So I think that was one way in which the film became cohesive. And then also, this is the third collaboration that Eileen and I had together. So there was also a tremendous sense of trust between the two of us as co-editors. We worked together on a film for Morgan called Best of Enemies about Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley and their 1968 debates. We worked on a film together recently that should be coming out pretty soon called Television Event. We actually finished that before Roadrunner, but it had a long award-winning festival run and it's going to be coming out soon. And through these different collaborations, we just developed, I think, a real sense of trust in each other's style and a sense of familiarity with each other's strengths, like what we're good at and how to lean on each other and collaborate in a way that I think we all knew as a team that there was going to be something very seamless, cohesive, and emotionally powerful and funny. I think it's one of the things I love about cutting with Eileen in particular is like there's a real playful and sense of humor that she brings to the edit. So I think that sort of vibrancy and vitality is something that you absolutely feel in the first part of the movie, and then we maintain and kind of modulate through the end as well.
I always think about these places where you can see, where the audience can feel someone thinking or realizing something. There's a great moment where one of Anthony's friends says, "Nothing feels better than coming home, and nothing feels better than leaving home." And he says, "Yeah, you got a point." And then he kind of spikes the camera and it holds. Do you remember that moment? Because to me, it was just a fantastic moment. You could have cut away immediately. "Yeah, I know what you mean. Cut." No, it's hold as he realizes the importance of what he's agreeing to or what this other person has said to him.
Yeah. Josh Homme, who is a good friend of Tony's, I think that idea was really what he and Josh, like, why they were friends and how they bonded over being people that were on the road all the time, but always longing for something else, longing for that sense of normalcy and stability of the home, and then longing for the excitement and travel and the road, and just having to constantly struggle with that in their lives. That was just a huge thing, I think, in Tony's life, that no matter where he was never actually satisfied. So it's a really important point to make about Tony.
I love, there's a moment, it's kind of like the famous edit in Lawrence of Arabia where he lights the match and he blows the match out to the sunset. There's a great cut from Tony killing a pig and the blood running into the river, cutting to the red carpet. I love that. Tell me about that edit. That's a great transition.
Yeah, I think that's a great example of how our creative process can unfold when we're all working together. So this edit, like I was saying before, it happened all remotely. And it was in that time period where everyone was still, and I think we still are, trying to figure out how to do remote edits as seamlessly as possible. But we were working on independent hard drives. We were doing Zooms every day. We also used Evercast as the edit got further along for Morgan to be able to feel the timing of edits and to be able to more quickly showcase for him different options and cuts and shots. But that particular cut was something that my memory of it is that it was something Morgan and I were talking about offhandedly, you know, like, "Hey, what if it was just this," to the, almost like as a joke, as, "Oh, that would be an interesting cut." And then Morgan was like, yeah, that's great. And so then I think Eileen actually made the cut, if I'm remembering right. But the way that we work sometimes at its best is when we have these like incredible exchanges. Like I remember on "Won't You Be My Neighbor," working with Morgan on the opening title sequence, and he was hearing the music from the opening of Fred Rogers' show, and it has this kind of celeste sound that's ascending. And he's like, "What if like every letter appeared as you were hearing one of those sounds?" And then we did that, and it was fun. And then he was like, "What if the color was just shifting in the background?" And there are these things that just happen, and it's through our interaction. And it's what I love about documentary editing, that there's so much freedom, there's so much improvisation. And one of the things that we really missed through that in-person experience but tried to create remotely was opportunities for us to have these interesting kind of what-if ideas. And so that was one. Like, what if we show the extremes of Tony's life? One moment on one day, he's killing a pig and standing in blood in the river. And then another moment, he's getting a Peabody Award standing on the red carpet. And how can we show that in just a cut?
Yeah, and we did a similar thing, I think, when cutting from him in Haiti, seeing the destruction of the earthquake, to him pushing his daughter on the swing. Just these like extreme disconnected lives that he was living and always having to go back and forth between.
During the favorite song section, there's a part where they talk about Tony's favorite song, and the visuals just match so beautifully. Can you talk about knowing that you had to cut that section and how it was built and how you found those great moments to illustrate that concept?
So part of the process of going through all the material, and this was happening all throughout the time that we were cutting, our co-producer, Vicky, our associate producer, Chloe, and our associate editor, Alana, and our assistant editor, they were always looking at raw material and pulling things, concepts, quotes, and then amazing visuals. So it was like all those ideas of what visuals could work for what concepts was always like a group collaboration. So we had, I think, just a lot of different bins of that type of material to work with. And there was just so much amazing footage, 10,000 hours, you know, it's endless. So we had just like a great team that we all understood what the film was about, what concepts we were trying to get across. And so every time one of us would find one of those golden nuggets that fit so perfectly with a particular concept, it was like we would all talk about it and celebrate and get excited.
Yeah. And that particular moment is David Chang, in interview, he's explaining to Morgan, look, like Tony seemed like this guy on the outside who was rock and roll and it was like all fun, but really his favorite song, which Dave is revealing to us in the movie, says a lot more about Tony's interior state, is this song that Dave feels like is a heroin song, is what he calls it. And it's a song, Anemone, by the Brian Jonestown Massacre. And Dave is trying to, in this scene, let Morgan in on some kind of knowledge that we're learning as viewers that's a new idea in the movie. And then in terms of the footage that we use to show Tony, there's this beautiful footage, like Eileen was mentioning, that had been flagged by our team of Tony walking around at night under a full moon and kind of staggering a little bit. And then he lays down in the field and is just observing the moon and moving around. And it fit this idea of something evocative that evoked a kind of like heroin experience. And so the dovetailing of this footage with that song, with Dave letting us in on this idea, it all came together in a way that helped illuminate this idea.
Another series of shots that I loved was when Tony says he's desperate and it cuts to a white horse in a pasture and some bumblebees. There's just something really profound about it. And visually, it just felt right. It just was, I loved that. Some great choices.
That footage is from the actual episode that they were shooting in Alsace, France, around the time that Tony took his life. And that was very sensitive material. And the executives at CNN screened all of the footage because they'd been filming for a few days at that point. They screened the footage and they allowed us some material. The footage that we had access to didn't include Tony, but it included all this beauty that was around him, all the things that they were filming. And so it was amazing that we had the opportunity to use any of that material and didn't have to try to pull from something that felt tonally different than the material that was being filmed for the show.
Two more questions for you, both basically about structure. Tell me about the order of the story. Addiction is mentioned early on in the doc, but it's not really explored till the end. That could have gone a different way, right? You could have talked about that in some different order than you did. Can you discuss how those ideas were structured throughout the film?
Yeah, so I think our basic initial idea for the structure was that the film starts with the publishing of Kitchen Confidential, and Act One is his rise to fame. So that's very chronological. As soon as we get into Act Two, where he starts traveling and becoming the creative writer and artist and host, he hates that word, but he's becoming who we all know him to be all throughout Act Two. And so we didn't want to do Act Two chronologically. We didn't want to say he did this show and then this show and then this show, and that's boring, you know, just like a greatest hits. Remember this episode and that episode, and then he went to CNN, and then. We really wanted to stay away from doing that. So Act Two was structured basically around ideas and concepts that became important to Tony. So like we had a section that was just about humanity, or a section that was just about
family.
Family. The importance of family. Exactly. And addiction was one of those concepts. But his addiction is essentially what led to his death, but it's not all of who he was. So like we wanted to focus on what made him the artist that he was and all of the things that contributed to that within Act Two. And then once we get into Act Three, where he's really struggling at the end, that's when like we really want to understand the addiction and how it was always there and that he never really dealt with that part of himself.
Yeah, and I think like while we don't get into talking about heroin until later on in the film, the idea of him having an addictive personality is something that we did want to carry through the whole film. Even things editorially that Eileen did early on, where you see Tony constantly smoking, constantly lighting up cigarettes.
Is constant.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's a great edit Eileen made where Tony is sitting in this old footage early in Act One. He lights a cigarette and then I think he starts to drop his hand. And then you see him walking outside of Joel Rose's apartment in New York and he's like smoking another cigarette and maybe his hand goes down or something. And showing that whether it was the writing that was the outlet for that energy or the smoking or later when he becomes a father, everything that he does, he like approaches with that same intensity and energy. So that is kind of threaded throughout while we don't talk about heroin until much later in the film.
Last question for you, which is the grief section. And how long was there a discussion and thoughts and different edit lengths where you decided how long can we afford to have the audience in this space, but also not to feel like it's skated over? I mean, you've got a tough boundary to set between not discussing it enough and discussing it so much that you're like, oh my gosh, I want to kill myself.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I worked on that part originally, and then we worked on the whole film collectively. But when I was working, first building that, a lot of it was much longer. And I think part of that has to deal with the fact that Morgan did the majority of the interviews within 2 years of Tony's passing. And so for a lot of the people speaking who were very close with him for decades, this was one of the first times they'd ever discussed it publicly at all. And so Morgan created these really intimate interviews and built up trust with everyone so that there was a lot of sharing how they were processing things, the complexity of trying to deal with Tony and his life at that time. And Morgan gave a lot of time. I think he said these interviews were some of the longest interviews he's ever done for a film. Normally his interviews will be close to an hour and he's very targeted and precise in what he wants. Unlike someone like maybe an Errol Morris who films over the course of many days with a subject. Normally Morgan's there about an hour. These were a couple hours, two, maybe three sometimes, and extremely emotional. And he said that for a lot of people, they've talked to him about how they were very therapeutic. So wanting to honor that same space, the edit also needed to slow down a bit and allow space for those experiences and expressions. But then when you have collectively a lot of space devoted to slow emotional expression, the overall weight of the film feels off and the end of the film felt long. And there were even things that we explored as we were talking about addiction, heroin, the idea of Tony joking about death throughout his life that were additional scenes that were cut completely from the film. There was a story that he told in a radio station in Alaska to a reporter where he talked about an earlier time in his life when he was about to take his own life. And so I think over time, as we sat with the film and we would watch it, you know, a real litmus test was, are we ourselves feeling emotional? Is this impacting us? Are we able to reflect back to the audience how we're feeling when we see the raw material? And Eileen and I would have conversations about this often if we were to make each other cry from the material. And so I think that was something that was really important to us, you know, honoring the experiences, the lived experiences of the people going through a really traumatic and probably still traumatic experience in their lives, and then not burdening the audience with so much that it just overwhelms the experience itself. So can you distill that material down in a way that retains the original emotional experience, honors people's experiences, and doesn't throw the balance off completely?
Did you guys do screenings outside of the team to make some of those judgments?
Yeah, this is another downside of the pandemic. We typically, on Morgan's films, we have a handful of in-person screenings. Every film I've worked on with him, there's at least five. And they always start out at Morgan's house with people he trusts, like his innermost circle. And the film is probably at its roughest stage at that point. And we get incredible feedback from people. And then it goes out to a different kind of group that's maybe people that work with us that are other editors and filmmakers, and on and out until it's like people who maybe don't know Morgan so much at all and wouldn't be giving notes based on their relationship with him. On this film, because of the pandemic, we only had one of those kind of screenings. It had to be outside. Everyone had to be separated and masked. And so the experience that you get as a filmmaker watching people watch your film being in the same room as people, it all was diluted and dispersed. And it was really hard to get a real sense for what that felt like for people to sit in a room and experience this film together. And so we were left with the option of sending people links and getting their feedback, which was really helpful. You get a sense of what's confusing to an audience, but the real sense of like how it played, I think we had to rely on our own judgment more than we would on other films.
I still haven't seen it in a theater with people, which is really sad because that's one of my favorite things to do. But when you're sitting outside and people are masked, it is really impossible to get all of those like subtle nuances that you get from those test screenings of facial expressions or even just feeling the energy. If you're so spaced out, you don't feel the energy of the person sitting next to you. It's just really difficult.
Yeah.
But I do think the one gift of this film during the pandemic was that we were all stuck in our houses, couldn't leave, couldn't travel, yet we were able to travel all over the world with Tony. And that was just such a gift for all of us. And we would talk about it all the time. Like, thank God we have this film right now.
That is a great place to wrap this up. Thank both of you for joining me and really sharing some great insight into editing documentary for the Art of the Cut audience.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. And again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for Topic-Driven, Curated Look at the Art and Craft of Editing. And be on the lookout for our upcoming video interview with the legendary editor Paul Hirsch, ACE, on our YouTube channel. Thanks to Sebastian Ray for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.